Boeri, it's here and now. There's disturbing new evidence today about the growing problem of mental health problems involving American soldiers in Iraq. A Department of Defense team reports today that more than a third of troops and military veterans currently suffer from mental health disorders, ranging from traumatic brain injury to post-traumatic stress disorder. What might be worse, the survey by the Pentagon Advisory Team finds that most of those suffering from post-traumatic stress are not being referred by the Pentagon for treatment. Army Times reporter Kelly Kennedy is covering the story. And Kelly, some of those numbers seem absolutely staggering. A third of the troops and close to 50% of men and women in the National Guard suffering from mental health problems. What was said about that at today's briefing?
Well, they said that they found in this study that the longer you've been in Iraq and the more times you've been deployed to Iraq, the more likely you are to suffer from a mental health issue. And so they're looking at that. They're trying to decide if they need to shorten terms, if they need to spend more time back home. Of course, right now they're extending deployments to 15 months in the Army, and soldiers are only spending a year in between deployments at home.
Well, this is particularly the nub of the problem here, but I understand the advisory team is telling them that they should extend those intervals between deployments to as many as 3 years. Now, how did they address that at this briefing, and what are the current standards?
Well, the Major General Gail Pollack, who is the Army Surgeon General, the Acting Surgeon General, said that the best option they have is to increase troop strength to bring in more soldiers into the Army so that there's more soldiers to deploy, so they have more time at home. But other than that, they don't really have an option.
But the current standard is what? About a year between deployments, yes?
It is. And in reality, about 3 months of that training can be spent away from home, or about 3 months of that year can be spent in training away from home. So they're actually home for 9 months.
So this study, if taken seriously by the Pentagon, it would seem to have major repercussions on troop levels at a time, of course, when the armed forces are already under severe pressure to come up with troops and more troops for the war effort.
Right. Yeah, the other finding that was interesting, and the first time it's actually been asked in combat, was the ethical questions. And what they're finding is that the soldiers who are over there the longest, who are seeing the most combat and who are deploying the most times, are the ones who are most likely to say that they would injure an Iraqi civilian, or that they have injured an Iraqi civilian by kicking or hitting or stealing their property just because they're angry, not because there was a reason for them to do so.
Kelly, what does the survey say? What percentage of Marines and soldiers answered that they wouldn't report a member of their own unit for killing or wounding an innocent Iraqi civilian?
That was one half. One half of soldiers and Marines said that they would not report abuse by another soldier to their command.
Did anybody at that press conference give a particular reaction to that, those numbers?
They did. Major General Pollack said when she was listening to that information, all she could do was put herself into a soldier's shoes and think, how would I react if my friends had been injured over there? And she said that the response might be normal, but that the training needs to be better so that they don't react in a bad way to those injuries of their friends.
Kelly, does this come as any surprise to the Pentagon? In September 2004, the Government Accounting Office was reporting that veterans' medical facilities were practically unanimous in warning they might not be able to meet the increasing demand for treating post-traumatic stress disorder. And an Army study back then in 2004 reported one in six soldiers was already reporting major problems of depression and stress disorder. Now that rate seems to be one in three, which, troubling enough, matches the rate associated with the war in Vietnam.
Right. I don't think that anyone is surprised by that. I think that that's why they're doing the studies. On the way out of the Pentagon, I was talking with Charles Hose, who is in charge of the PTSD studies at Walter Reed, and he said they've had full support from the command, and that the reason they're doing these studies is because they know there are problems and they're trying to address them. So, yeah, I don't think that this came as a surprise to anybody.
In the few seconds remaining, does the survey come with any mandate to action?
It does. More ethics training, more leadership training, and more suicide prevention training.
Kelly Kennedy, a staff reporter for the Army Times. She's joined us from the Pentagon. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
Here in Boston, we're in the middle of the great spring migration of warblers and other songbirds from their wintering grounds in the tropics. One great place to spot them in springtime is the Arnold Arboretum. The botanist Peter Ashton used to direct the Arboretum, which is part of Harvard University, and he spent 50 years studying the world's tropical forests, from which songbirds fly to the temperate zones in springtime. Never before have the world's tropical forests been so threatened by unsustainable levels of logging, clear-cutting for agriculture and biofuels, and now by global warming. This year, Professor Ashton was recognized for his work in tropical forests by the Science and Technology Foundation of Japan and was awarded the prestigious Japan Prize. When Professor Ashton recently joined us, I asked him to start out painting a picture of one of his favorite tropical forests.
Well, that's an exciting prospect. As a matter of fact, going into tropical forest in Borneo, where I spent much of my early days, is not that different from going down to Cape Cod. You go in among those pines and you smell the resin on a hot summer's day. You hear the crackling in the air. You hear the insects coming out. And to go into some of the forests in Borneo, it's amazingly similar. You smell the resin, but the resin is not coming from pine trees. It's coming from the family of tropical trees, the dipterocarps, sometimes called Philippine mahoganies, that have produced the greater part of tropical hardwoods on world markets over the last 30 years. Needless to say, the source is now almost exhausted.
I have to tell you that the first time I set foot in a tropical forest, in a rainforest, I was just stunned by the diversity of it all. It was just it was almost a sort of a psychedelic experience seeing this diversity and multi-story layers of the canopy.
That's very true. And, of course, most of the biodiversity for which these forests are completely unique, the rainforests of the tropics, the equatorial regions, must contain at least 70% of all the species of animals, plants, insects, fungi, other microorganisms on Earth. And a large proportion of them depend on the tree species, chemical defenses of the trees broken down by individual specialized organisms. In the U.S., I think I'm right in saying that we have maybe 450 native tree species. In an area the size of the Arnold Arboretum in Borneo, particularly northern Borneo, Sarawak, Brunei, you could come across 1,200 tree species. In other words, three times what we've got in the whole continental U.S.
It strikes me in those 50 years, over 50 years that you've been doing natural history, you must have seen the destruction of vast expanses of forests. Most of us look back at our lives and just see how, and just sort of are amazed at how quickly the time has changed. Do you look back and think of how amazingly quickly those forests have passed?
Yes, I do. One of the exciting new developments is discovery that many of the species of tree in these forests are, we know now more or less how old they are, and quite a lot of them, possibly the majority of them, are somewhere between 5 and 10 million years old. Now, how old is our species? And then we think, you know, in my 50 years in the Far East, many of those species have disappeared. So we as one species, within one lifetime, are in the process of eliminating a system, an ecosystem, a forest that has been on Earth, at least in places, for vastly longer.
And much, and I take it even probably most of those forests you saw in Southeast Asia are gone now.
Well, the forests are not gone. A lot of the forests are still there. If you look at the statistics, you will see that Malaysia, for instance, still claims to be somewhere like 60% forested. But they're not the Aboriginal forests. These are forests that have been logged and often greatly degraded. But there are still patches of Aboriginal forest, the original highly biodiverse forest, conserved in wildlife sanctuaries, national parks, etc., islands in a sea of degradation and indeed conversion to the commodity crops, mainly rubber and, of course, nowadays, oil palm.
This award from the Science and Technology Foundation of Japan points to your development of these permanent study plots in forests that you and your successors can go back and monitor for many years afterwards. What have you found out so far from those plots?
Well, this started a long time before when I first went to Borneo. And I started trekking out there, sometimes for 3 months at a time, into the forest, going up the rivers in dugout canoes, walking along the ridges. And I began to collect the leaves of the species I recognized in a little bag at my waist, and at the end of the day, writing down the lists of species and the places where I found them. And I found that on different geologies, I got different species. On different soils, I got different species. So it wasn't just a random mix. But in spite of that, in any one habitat, we now know there may be 600 or 700 tree species.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Ashton, winner of this year's Japan Prize. And we're also joined by Stuart Davies, director of the Center for Tropical Forest Science, which Professor Ashton co-founded. It's a joint program between Harvard and the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute. And Stuart, one major change to look for in those plots might be the effect of global warming. And those tropical forests are seen as hugely important, aren't they?
Absolutely. There's a huge scientific debate going on at the moment as to how forests regulate climate and how forests will respond in these circumstances. The science is still out on whether or not elevated carbon dioxide will result in increased growth of tropical trees, as we might expect from first principles. The beauty of the network that Peter was instrumental in starting is that we can now start to address this question on a global scale. We're working in 15 countries right across Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and now we have the opportunity to monitor forests at the right scale to address the questions.
That's Stuart Davies, director of the Center for Tropical Forest Science, which was co-founded by Dr. Peter Ashton, the former director of the Arnold Arboretum here in Boston, and professor emeritus at Harvard University. Ashton was recently recognized for his groundbreaking research on conservation and the sustainable use of tropical forests. We'll have more with both of them coming up. And later in the show, what does Edward Hopper tell us about diners and about America, here and now? It's Here and Now. We've been speaking with Professor Peter Ashton, winner of this year's Japan Prize, for the work he has done in tropical forests. Stuart Davies also joined us. He's director of the Center for Tropical Forest Science, of which Ashton is co-founder. A key to the center's work is those plots that Ashton first laid out many years ago in an attempt to preserve forests in their original state and also to monitor them over time and as the environment around them changed. With all the pressures on these forests, from logging for furniture and building material and for agricultural land to grow soybeans and palm oil and biofuel, I asked Ashton what he says to people who ask why we should worry about preserving the biodiversity in these forests.
Who cares about the biodiversity? That question is very similar to asking the question, who cares about the Library of Congress? We as taxpayers are willing to pay for the Library of Congress because though the corridors in there may only be visited once every 10 years by researchers, every now and then a major discovery is made. That's exactly the same with the genetic information in biodiversity. How much are we paying for that biodiversity, which is owned largely by the poor countries of the world? We aren't paying 1 cent. We are free riders. Unless we get used to the idea that we have to pay some rental for that, I'm not optimistic for the future.
Stuart, while well-intended, creating markets for rainbow or rainforest crunch is not going to provide an alternative to cutting trees down in massive logging and agriculture, is it?
No, not at all. But there are, I think, one has to remember that one of the critical problems with forestry in the tropics is that we know a lot about the ecological principles and how trees regenerate and how trees grow and the cycles on which one could harvest these forests. But by and large, those regulations, those ecological principles are never followed. So logging can be conducted, it should be conducted sustainably, but it just isn't at the moment. And I think if it were, then this would create a whole spectrum of new opportunities for indigenous and non-indigenous communities in Borneo, for example.
Yes, I would certainly buy that one. The difficulty is that there are two interested parties. There is the logger, who is interested in taking out timber and usually has a very short-term license. And there are the representatives of the people, namely the politicians. And they're only in for a short time. They should be representing the people of the country that own those forests, as they usually do nowadays. But because they're only elected for 5 or 10 years, that isn't really where their interest lies. And that's the key to the problem. If you're going to try and get out the maximum you can in as short a time as possible, that's totally in conflict with the idea of sustaining the resource in the long term.
So in the context of current schemes for carbon trading, you're suggesting that perhaps the developed countries in the world might pay the owners of these forests to preserve the forests or to do more sustainable logging to protect them and preserve them.
I am indeed suggesting that. I'll give you just one example of the kind of problem. Oil palm plantations yield something like 7 times per acre per annum that sunflowers or flax do in temperate climates. How can a country put that aside in favor of conserving forests, which yield so much less over the whole forest cycle?
You have a terrific idea with the Center for Tropical Science. That's a great initiative, but it sounds as if you are up against tremendous forces here in stopping or discouraging or slowing deforestation.
Sure. That's I think our approach to it is to develop methods, new technologies from our knowledge of how primary forests function and take that into lands that have been degraded. And I'll give you an example of a project we're doing in Panama, where we want to ask the question, what's the role of forests in regulating water flows into the Panama Canal? Panama Canal is an extremely important economic resource for the government of Panama. We know exactly how much water costs going into that canal because every ship that goes through has to pay money to use the water. It's all dependent on the success of the watershed in regulating those flows. So we're setting up an experiment down there to monitor exactly the value of different kinds of vegetation types in the canal. By that I mean degraded land, silviculture or forestry land, and primary forest, and asking what's the relative value of taking the forest away. And we can quantify the economics of that very carefully. And I think with that kind of work, we're starting to really move to asking not only what's the ecological value of these biodiverse forests, but also what does it mean to the people in cities that surround these forests?
Well, it is easy to despair. We should probably encourage the good. Certainly, congratulations, Professor Ashton, on the Japan Prize. Congratulations to you and to Stuart as well for your work with the Center for Tropical Forest Science. And maybe you should take us out of this with some particularly inspiring picture from the forest, Professor Ashton. Can you tell us maybe about your favorite moment in the forest over all these years?
My favorite moment in the forest, I actually have many favorite moments, but just to go along those ridges at about 3,000 feet in Borneo, day after day with a basket with your food on your back, and to listen to the water cascading down in those valleys, to look at the clouds accumulating on the ridges, knowing it's going to pelt with rain by midday, and that you strip off into everything except for your sneakers and your underwear, put all your clothes in a plastic bag, and walk on with that streaming rain all over your body until it stops an hour or two later, and put your clothes back on again, and you'll think, wow, this is the tropics, and there's no better place in the world.
Well said. Professor Peter Ashton of Harvard University and the Center for Tropical Forest Science. With him, Stuart Davies, who's the director now of the Tropical Forest Science Program that Professor Ashton co-founded a number of years ago. Congratulations again on your prize. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Back in the temperate zone, and next week on Here and Now, how our national farm policy winds up feeding an epidemic of obesity and diabetes. And the epic of the Middle Ages comes to DVD. One man and his harp to Beowulf. That's next week. Still ahead today, a look at the mayor's race in Philadelphia, where homicide and corruption top the list of voter concerns. Here and now.
Support for
Harry, in for Robin Young, and it's Here and Now. Let's take a break from the 2008 presidential election to look at another primary in a major American city, and this one is tantamount to the final election. It's in the city of brotherly love, the colonial city of Philadelphia, where our next guest calls this year's race for mayor the first postmodern election in the city's history. In a field of six, there are three serious African-American candidates, two congressmen, one millionaire, and no incumbent. The city has the highest homicide rate to date in its history, and there's been a major scandal in city government as well. But polls show undecided is one of the top vote getters. And turnout for the primary on May 15th may be low. With us on the line is Tom Ferrick, columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And Tom, why, when you're dealing with murder and corruption, does there seem to be so little interest in the race?
Well, we've got five good candidates running. There's not a lot of anger in the air. They tend to agree on all the issues. For instance, they're all against crime and murder. And they all offer us solutions, and they're beginning to sound a little bit like peas in the pod. The differences between them are not major. So I think you've got people sort of standing back and saying, who's the best person? None of them really get my juices flowing. And we'll see whether or not that turns out into low turnout.
But what about anger at either the murder rate or the corruption in City Hall?
You know, in Philadelphia, at any time in the last 100 years, you could be angry about what's going on. And I think people are used to that. I do think that people are upset about crime. The polls tell us so. They're upset about the homicide rate. They're upset about the corruption in City Hall. But most of the candidates have the advantage of not being connected with any of that in a bad way. Most of them have positioned themselves as reformers. And so as a consequence, they escape some of that voter ire.
You have a number of serious candidates. And from the surveys, we see at the top of the field is a multimillionaire in the mold of Michael Bloomberg. Outsider, business perspective, fresh face. That's Tom Knox. Who is he?
He's sort of Michael Bloomberg without the personality. He's not the most interesting guy in the world, but he certainly has the most interesting campaign commercials. His campaign is being done by a political consultant named Joe Trippi, who, if you recall, last did the Howard Dean campaign and has been around the business since the memory of man runneth to the contrary. Joe has done a wonderful job in positioning Tom Knox as the outsider and the reformer, and he's done it with about $6 to $7 million to spend on television advertising, all of it in Knox's money. So in the land of the blind, the guy with the money can be king, and so far Knox has been dominating the airways and dominating the polls, although it's not a runaway.
Tell me a little more about who he is.
He is, if you see his commercials, and his commercials are correct, he's a Philadelphian born and bred. His father was disabled when Tom was young. He ended up living for a time in public housing projects. He went into the Navy to help support his family even before he graduated from high school, got his GED later, and made his fortune, and it is indeed a considerable fortune. It's probably $100 million or more, or so he hints, at insurance and banking.
Interestingly enough, Knox is polling well amongst black voters, while the candidate who's polling second here, the black man, isn't polling well with blacks. Longtime now former city councilor Michael Nutter. Tell us more about him and why he's polling the way he is.
Michael is I've said before that this may be our first postmodern racial election in Philadelphia, where you have a black candidate who's getting significant white support. In fact, the majority of his support comes among white voters as we speak. And you have a white candidate in Tom Knox who's got a significant slice of black votes so far. It looks like people are looking beyond race to a certain degree. Michael has bona fides in his years in city council as A, being an opponent of John Street, who's the current and very unpopular mayor, and B, a lot of bona fides on reform. He's the guy who helped pass an ethics law. He's the guy that passed the smoking ban in council. And this is in a legislative body where you don't get much done. And he got a lot done, and that has made him the darling of the liberals and others in the city. And most of them happen to be white.
We should point out that your newspaper, the Philadelphia Inquirer, has already endorsed Michael Nutter. And the competition, the Philadelphia Daily News, did the same today. Does a newspaper endorsement count for very much?
It does. In a race like this, I mean, here you have a race where you have one of the candidates, Knox, has been sort of in the mid-20s. You have Michael Nutter and Chaka Fatah, who are sort of in the high teens to low 20s. And then you have two candidates in Dwight Evans and Bob Brady, sort of in the low teens. So in a race like that, any factor that tilts, 10, 20, 30, 40,000 voters is an important one. And a newspaper endorsement, I think, is pretty important.
You know, the crime has gotten so bad in some neighborhoods of Philadelphia, as you know, that people have dubbed it Killadelphia. And you have a quarter of the city living below the poverty level, that corruption scandal, too, in City Hall. What is the election going to be about in the end?
Well, elections in Philadelphia tend to be about race in the end. The big question is whether or not that will happen this time. In a sense, all the candidates are strong candidates. All of them, in a way, would have great strengths that they bring to the mayor's office. So it's really a question of who do you think is the one that's closest to your point of view or closest to your skin color. And in Philadelphia, we've tried to work out our racial differences here for something like 50 years. That's in the modern era. And you may recall that our mayor in the 70s was Frank Rizzo, who sort of personified the white, anti-black, ethnic rage that happened. And it was a tough decade. And ever since then, we've been trying to work out how we live together in this city of about 1.5 million. That's majority-minority. You know, we've got about 45% African-American, about 40% white, and about 15% Asian, Hispanic. And this election is showing that the best way to do that is through the electoral process. Because we don't have a lot of rage. We don't have a lot of race baiting. We have candidates who are out there talking about the issues, and whether they're white or brown or green or yellow, in some cases that isn't making as big a difference as it used to.
And yet, Tom,
yeah.
In reaction to those murders, I recently read in the Philadelphia Inquirer of someone wishing that Frank Rizzo was back. And you have a black mayoral candidate, Mr. Nutter, who's calling for a policy of stop, question, and frisk.
Right. Well, Frank was, before he was mayor, he was the top cop, as they say, and a tough guy. And at a time when we've got an absence of leadership in the city hall and in the police department on this issue, someone who's going to come out and speak declarative sentences on it and says that something can be done is going to get some support. That's number one. Number two, maybe black leaders are against stop and frisk, but if you go into some of these neighborhoods, you're going to find out people are awfully upset about not being able to sit on their front steps because they're in danger of being shot by a stray bullet shot by a 17-year-old who owns a Glock. And they're a little bit tired of it, and I think they'd like to see more of a police presence. All of these guys, all of the candidates, without exception, are calling for the city to either hire more police or set up surveillance cameras.
Tom Ferrick, thanks a lot.
Thank you, dude.
Keep that copy coming. Tom Ferrick, a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Later in the show, Edward Hopper's America, the diners, the lighthouses, storefronts. We'll visit a new exhibit that shows almost all his work, from one of his first self-portraits to one of his last paintings. You're listening to Here and Now.
Kirilenko again on the hold. On Tracy McGrady, so Kirilenko with his
For most of us, a foul call during a professional basketball game is just part of the action. But for Justin Wolfers, it's a window on racial bias in American society. Wolfers, a business professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, studied 600,000 foul calls during more than 13 NBA seasons and found that white referees call fouls on black players at a greater rate than against white players, and that black refs did the same toward white players. Professor Wolfers joins us now, and you say that this bias can affect the outcome of games. How so?
The estimates here suggest that the own race bias is subtle. It's pervasive, but subtle. And so it looks like white players get fewer fouls and score more points under white referees than black players. And in reverse, black referees appear to give fewer fouls against black players than against white players. Now, even if the effects are relatively small, and I think it's fair to say they may well be, in a league in which 3.5% of games go to overtime, even these very small but systematic effects on fouling and then subsequently player behavior end up changing the outcomes of a reasonable number of games.
Professor, can it be argued that in a game that moves as quickly as basketball, there isn't time in such split-second decisions for making biased decisions?
There may not be time for one to reach back and think about levels of hate or malice. But when you face a split-second judgment, you don't have as much time for the cognitive side to kick in and really allow a slow evaluation. And so the question essentially that we're asking, and this research addresses, is a referee sees physical contact on the court, two players clash. Well, he has to decide, was that a charge or a block? And the question we ask is, does the skin color of those players affect how his brain interprets the signals that his eyes are giving him?
As opposed to other factors. I mean, critics note that these 600,000 fouls you've looked at lack context.
Absolutely.
Referees call fouls differently at the end of a close game, for example. They call fouls differently toward all-stars than toward regular players. That you've not sorted those out.
I think the general criticism that fouls are the wrong thing to look at is a fair criticism, and it's a good one from any basketball fan. Now, I think you and I are willing to admit that a field goal is a field goal is a field goal. And so when a white player plays under a predominantly white refereeing crew, on average, he scores half a point more per 48 minutes than when he plays under an all-black crew. Mm. And so we also aggregate up and look at the level of the team. And so there are some teams with more black players and some with a few more white players. Those teams, the entire team, is more likely to win when the refereeing crew more closely matches the racial composition of the players.
As you're well aware, the NBA and others are shouting foul at you. The NBA, where, 80% of the players are black, says that when it saw a draft copy of your report last year, it did its own study, and according to Commissioner David Stern, it found no bias.
Have you ever seen a copy of that study? The New York Times saw a copy of the study. They sent it to three of the leading economists in the country, and they suggested that the NBA's analysis just didn't hold water.
In a piece in the Boston Globe, basketball writer Bob Ryan says that in 38 years of covering the NBA, he's never heard anyone criticize a referee for being biased.
The question that I think Bob's trying to get at is, are these missed calls systematic and systematically related to race? The truth is, these are subtle effects. I'm not surprised that a fan who has lots of bad calls to complain about hasn't noticed the correlation between that and player race. Mm. That's why we do statistical analysis.
Presuming that, in fact, your findings are one and the same with reality, what is your recommendation here as to what you do about this?
I don't think there's any easy solutions here. It may well be we're finding small levels of bias, but they're still systematic. But we're finding it by both black and white referees. And so at the end of the day, someone's going to get a little bit screwed.
But to follow your research, the only solution that could come of this, the only appropriate one, would be to balance your referees in racially proportional numbers.
That way everyone gets screwed half the time. I mean, there's already a bunch of things the league is doing right towards addressing this. And this, again, is one of the reasons I think it's reasonable to guess, and this is not a research finding, but a guess, that there's less bias in the NBA than there is in most other social contexts.
Justin Wolfer is an assistant business professor at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks.
Still ahead, Edward Hopper's America, here and now. It's here and now. Say the name Edward Hopper. and his evocative images immediately spring to life. They're images of American life from the Jazz Age through the years following World War II. You probably even have a postcard of his most famous picture, Nighthawks, which is one of the paintings in a new exhibition which opens Sunday at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts. The exhibit starts with a 1903 self-portrait and ends with a painting called Sun in an Empty Room, which Hopper finished in 1963, 4 years before he died. The selection echoes the moods and themes that run through Hopper's work, the fall of light and shadow, and solitude in the midst of the city's noise and energy. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock toured the exhibit with curator Carol Troyan.
Edward Hopper is one of the most enduringly popular American artists. He came to fame in the 1920s, and basically his career, his popularity, his reputation has never faltered. He worked for about 20 years in relative obscurity. He was in New York, he was painting, he was trying to get his works exhibited, occasionally successful. He was trying to get critics to notice him, rarely successful. He was trying to sell his work, not successful at all. Then in 1923, and he's 40 years old, he goes to Gloucester, Massachusetts, paints a couple of watercolors, exhibits one at a show at the Brooklyn Museum. The Brooklyn Museum buys the watercolor. His career takes off from that point, and there's no turning back. No other realist seemed to have kept a hold of the public's imagination the way he has. In the early 1950s, when abstract expressionism is the American style, magazines run articles about the two greatest artists in America today, Jackson Pollock and Edward Hopper.
I read a quote in the book that comes with the exhibit. I think it was Walter Lippmann who said, "The clamor of the city does not really represent the ideal," and obviously Hopper believed in that.
Hopper had a wonderful taste for the everyday, for the ordinary. He was not interested in the modern, per se. He wasn't interested in the glamour, the noise, the spectacular newness of New York. He was an inveterate walker. He wandered around the city all the time, on foot, on the elevated train, just looking, and his observations tucked into his brain. He'd bring back to the studio, combine with other observation, and produce wonderful pictures. But they're pictures of you and me. They're pictures of ordinary people and ordinary places, middle-class restaurants, storefronts without a whole lot in them, pharmacies at night with big bowls full of colored water to attract your attention, but with rather unglamorous advertisements over the windows, including one for Ex-Lax in the MFA's great picture called Drugstore. Hopper painted what he saw and what his companions and friends saw and walked by. Hopper didn't walk by. He stopped. He saw the interest in these places and made of them something magical. So he's a master, I think, at finding pictures in very unpicturesque places.
The highlight for a lot of people who will come to the exhibit is Nighthawks. Tell me why this painting speaks to so many people.
I think there's a good reason why everybody knows and admires Nighthawks. It is a picture that speaks its date. It's 1942. The war is on. The cultural heroes of the era are the hard-boiled detectives that patrol the streets of New York and Los Angeles and San Francisco, operating under their own high moral code, but outside the system. And so Nighthawks creates an image that we already have of the cultural scene at this point. It's a picture of tremendous ambiguity. The diner, the all-night diner that's the focus of this picture, stretches and has impossibly long plate glass windows into which we can see, but which provides no entrance. Hopper deliberately doesn't show us how you can get into this building. The landscape around is completely depopulated. The streets are cold and blue. There is a row of brownstones like the ones we've seen before in his pictures across the street. There's nobody in them either. All the windows are dark. We assume it must be very, very late at night. And there are, in this all-night diner, the soda jerk, and three people. A man with his back to us, wearing a fedora and having one cup of coffee, and then two people, a man and a woman, sitting together at the counter, although Hopper doesn't really make it clear whether they came in together or whether they met here. And the picture is one that just has so many possible explanations, so many stories that come to mind, and you don't have any idea which of them, if any, or all Hopper meant. If you've read a lot of pulp fiction and detective novels, you assume that any minute some gangster is going to come in with a Tommy gun and rub them all out. They're all hard, not very appealing-looking people. On the other hand, it may be that this all-night diner is something of an oasis in the cold, empty, unfriendly city. And you wonder whether, in fact, these people have been drawn to that interior, drawn to what Hemingway, who was one of Hopper's favorite authors, called a clean, well-lighted place, because of the consolations of solitude, of having a cup of coffee in the company of strangers and feeling, therefore, less alone.
We're here in the last room, the final room of the Edward Hopper exhibition, and although it's not his last painting, it's the latest painting in the exhibition here at the MFA, and it's called Sun in an Empty Room. Tell me why you feel this painting sums up the Edward Hopper exhibit and his career.
Hopper painted Sun in an Empty Room in 1963. He was 81, I believe, and would continue to paint for another couple of years. He died in 1967. It's a painting that returns to any number of the themes that he's dealt with throughout his life, only now so pared down, so austere, so empty of content, and yet so full of meaning. It is simply what the title says, Sun in an Empty Room, a room with no people, no furnishings whatsoever. We see a patch of sun illuminating two walls. Other walls are in shadow. And the longer you look at it, the more incongruous the space seems. And you begin to think it's not a real space, but the space of one's imagination. It's a picture that reduces you to silence. It's a picture that you want to stand in the middle of and just be. Someone asked him what he was after with this picture, and he said, "I'm after me." I don't think he meant he was after his life story. I don't think he meant he was after justification as an artist. I think what he was driving at is that he was interested throughout all his life is in rendering his vision of the world. And in this, one of his last paintings, I think he comes closest to doing that in its purest form.
Carol Troyan is curator of the Edward Hopper exhibit at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. The exhibition opens Sunday and runs through August. Later this year, the exhibit moves to the National Gallery of Art in Washington, and then to the Art Institute of Chicago. For more, visit our website, here-now.org. By the way, you're listening to Self-Portrait in Three Colors by Mingus. Charles Mingus, Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm David Boeri. Join us again on Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David.